The thing about addiction, it doesn't discriminate. It can affect anyone from any walk of life. Doesn't matter if you're rich, poor, young, or old, or what kind of job you have. Take Sonia Kalan, for example. She was a successful orthodontist who built a thriving 7-location orthodontic group. No one knew that Sonia struggled with alcohol addiction. Every day, following her long 16-hour work shifts, she would turn to drinking.
It was super busy. We had several orthodontists working for us. At some point, I wasn't even seeing patients anymore. But the stress level of running a business, like nothing compared to being an orthodontist. And so I was using it for anxiety. And then it was sort of having the opposite effect. By the time I would wake up in the mornings, I was a disaster. There's a voice that tells you that something's not right, like in your body. But every time I came close to kind of being like, maybe I should stop, I'd be like, but you're so high functioning. What are you gonna do? Like, are you gonna come home and exercise, meditate, journal? Like, I don't have time for that, but I have time for a bottle of wine.
But Sonia did eventually take time to focus on her sobriety. And now this highly motivated woman is channeling her experience into a new business that provides online small group recovery meetings. Join us on this episode as Sonia opens up about her struggle, how she overcame it, and her mission to help others do the same. I'm Angela Kenneke, your host of Grieving Out Loud. The reason I started this podcast and my charity, Emily's Hope, is because of the heartbreaking loss I experienced when my 21-year-old daughter, Emily, died from fentanyl poisoning. That devastating loss changed my life forever. But instead of allowing the pain to consume me, I decided to take action. That's why we're here today, to help reduce the stigma surrounding substance use disorder and bring awareness to this important issue. Well, Sonia, welcome so much to Grieving Out Loud. It's a pleasure to have you, and I can't wait to learn more about your story.
Thank you for having me, Angela.
Let's start at the beginning. I was doing a little research on you. I see you were a very successful orthodontist. That's a big job. There's a lot of demand for orthodontists. It's good money, all of those things. Tell me a little bit about how you went into becoming an orthodontist.
So I'm a child of Indian immigrants from Canada, and there's like three options for what you're allowed to do. It's dentist, doctor, and lawyer was sort of like at the lower end of it. And so I honestly didn't think about it that much. I just thought, this is what you do. And this is what all my cousins and my parents' friends' children were doing. So just went into it without thinking about it. And to be honest, I didn't love being a dentist. And so I was in dental school and I was like, what do I do here? And the dean of students was like, well, you're doing really well. So apply to a specialty. And so I did. And I was like, this is the one where I least have to touch people and the least amount of blood and the least amount of needles. And I was like, this is great. And I really did. I do love being orthodontist. It was a really great career path. And so, yeah, that's exactly how I picked it.
I've heard that about the Indian culture before, that it is very strict with like what children are sort of given the parameters of what they can consider doing. Yeah. Do you feel if you hadn't grown up under those conditions, you might have gone down a different path?
Oh, like 100%. Like I was born to be a dentist or a doctor, but definitely wasn't a passion. I can't even go back and wonder what I would have done because it started so early. But luckily, being an orthodontist gave me an opportunity to do whatever I wanted. Like now being able to help people in sobriety. And so I'm really super grateful for it. So I try not to go back. The only thing I think I like, maybe I would have wanted to be like a journalist, but you know, I can't even think of it now.
Well, I am a journalist. That was always my dream. And I do. I love journalism. I love storytelling. It does lend to podcasting and that kind of thing, too. So I'm grateful that I got to live out my dream and be a journalist. It wasn't always easy, though. You know, you think you're going to do whatever it is that you dream of doing. And there's always pitfalls or downsides to anything, right?
Yeah, it just looks so glamorous. Like you're going to uncover like the next.
Yeah, not glamorous at all. I can guarantee you, not glamorous. Well, let's talk about, because you did do sort of a 360 shift. I mean, what you're doing now isn't related to what you started off in life doing. So what brought you to that point?
So I got out of school and I started working for a corporate dental practice and was like, this is terrible. Like I went to school for how many years to end up sort of like in this environment where just like, I didn't feel any autonomy. It just wasn't a comfortable environment. So I thought, well, just open like a small little practice. And so I found a building that had already been fit out for a dental office. And I was like, okay, well, this will be cute. I'll have a nice little practice. I can set my own hours and I'll be able to buy a house and a car and pay off my student loans. And that was really the goal. I would have been really happy with that. And then 6 months later, another office in the same kind of situation came up for sale. It wasn't a running office, but it was built out. And so we bought that. And then sort of once you do it the second time, you're definitely more aware like of what you can handle. And so just got the opportunity to keep doing it over the next several years. And so by the time we were done, so by 2016, we had 7 offices. It was super busy. We had several orthodontists working for us. At some point, I wasn't even seeing patients anymore, but the stress level of running a business, like nothing compared to being an orthodontist. And so I had been drinking. I'd started drinking when I was like 15, but I'd been in school for so long. So I was always sort of like binge drinking, studying, binge drinking, studying. And then when I started working and the stress sort of started increasing, that's the only tool I had. And so I started drinking every day in the evenings.
What was your drink of choice while you were working and drinking? Anything?
Red wine.
So it strikes me, and I've done a couple of podcasts about women and alcohol and different things, and it strikes me that it's very socially acceptable for women to drink wine.
I think we have views of what someone with an alcohol use problem looks like, and it's not a woman with a glass of wine, right? Like, that's not the vision that we have in our head of somebody who has an addiction or who has an alcohol addiction or what we call an alcohol use disorder now in addiction research. And so it can be easier to overlook, perhaps, when that one glass of wine turns into two, turns into three, turns into the bottle, turns into a couple of bottles.
That was Dr. Jessica Mellinger, a liver doctor at the University of Michigan. She's seeing more young women with liver disease and says for the first time in history, women are drinking as much as men.
All the downsides of drinking, which could include getting liver disease, you know, kind of my area of specialty, you know, cancers. Alcohol use is associated with a whole host of cancers. And then the kind of associated mental health issues that can happen along with that, increased depression, increased anxiety, insomnia problems. And alcohol has a lot of downsides to it. And so I think the overall message that wine is healthy is really starting to be questioned.
Mellinger hopes that by educating women about what moderate drinking really looks like, it will turn this potentially deadly trend around.
A safe level of alcohol for people who don't have an alcohol use problem, who don't have liver disease, who don't have medical issues from alcohol, is no more than one drink a day for women or 2 drinks a day for men. And then that raises the question of what is a drink, right? So one drink is about 4 ounces of wine. So that would fill up really only the bottom, right?
Yes. You think about a typical wine glass. And so if I'm going to fill up a wine glass, I'll fill it up about halfway full, which is 2 servings, right?
Probably 2 servings, yeah.
Wow.
And then one shot is one serving. One standard 12-ounce can of beer is one serving.
Sonia realized she had a problem when she was downing a whole bottle of wine every night, but still managed to function pretty well. Her work was not impacted by her drinking. Sonia believes that actually may have caused her to battle with substance use disorder longer before seeking help.
In the Indian culture, men drank pretty heavily, and so women didn't drink at all. And so I kind of knew the signs, but for me, it was like these guys were so low functioning, right? They were like getting in DUIs, they were getting in arguments, they were going to jail. And so I struggled for a long time being like, well, I'm so high functioning. I built a business. Like I built this huge successful business. But I think, you know, I think that there's a voice that tells you that something's not right, like in your body. But every time I came close to kind of being like, maybe I should stop, but you're so high functioning. What are you going to do? Like, are you going to come home and exercise, meditate, journal? Like, I don't have time for that, but I have time for a bottle of wine. And so I got so lucky that I got an offer to sell the business. And it was like an offer like no one would ever turn down. And I was, by that point, I had spiraled. I was sick all the time. I was hungover all the time. mentally had spiraled, right? Which I always think there's some combination between addiction and mental health. And so I was using it for anxiety. And then it was sort of having the opposite effect by the time I would wake up in the mornings. I was a disaster. I just knew that there was more in life than that. So I got the offer to sell. I knew that it was the first time in my life I wouldn't be busy like 16 hours a day. And I thought, what am I going to do with this extra time? I'm going to end up drinking. And so I literally just quit cold turkey with great difficulty. But I just had a particularly vicious hangover one morning. I was with a friend of mine who was pregnant and we were at brunch and the waiter was like, do you want a mimosa? And I was like, no, I don't. I don't. And I think it's the first time I ever turned down a drink in my entire life. And something just hit me that day where I was like, I was seeing like black spots. That's how hungover I was. And I completely blacked out the night before, which was by that point pretty normal for me to be totally blacked out. But I don't know. It wasn't like a rock bottom.
So it wasn't anything earth shattering either. It wasn't like something really horrible happened because of your drinking. You just were sick of it.
Yeah, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. It really was. It was like, I think I had been waiting for something earth shattering to happen. Like I'd come close a couple times to falling down the stairs or, you know, something. I didn't drink and drive. So it wasn't that, but it was like, I thought something would happen, like that I would end up having to quit or I'd be forced to quit. And so that just wasn't happening. And at that point, I'm like over a decade in to a significant alcohol problem.
Did you have any other health problems because of the alcohol, any liver problems or any other issues?
No, I feel like being high functioning in physically and mentally is not necessarily a gift. I always tell people because it's like lets you get away with it for so much longer. But no, I was pretty physically, I felt awful, but there were no actual, like there was not a lab test you could run that would say that there was a problem.
And most people can't just stop, right? Most people can't just quit cold turkey. So why do you think you could do that? And did it stick? Did it last?
It did. I think that I had one day one. That was it. And I did the same thing with cigarettes 10 years earlier. I had done the same thing. And so I just quit. I was sick one day. I think I had pneumonia. I was smoking a cigarette outside and I was like, I'm not doing this anymore. But I think for me, it was just, I don't know. I never tried even to go a day without alcohol. I think people kind of like prepare for it for longer. And so I think that there was just this, like, I had a reserve of willpower sort of stored up, right? From not even having tried it ever. And so I was like, do it. And it was horrible. It was like, I had really bad anxiety. I didn't sleep for a while. It was, yeah, it wasn't easy for sure. I don't want to give the impression it was easy. I don't know if I would say it was full
withdrawal.
Yeah. But I was, yeah, for sure, jittery. There were definitely, yeah, it was like a whole, it was like, I always explain it like being like a turtle without a shell. Like I was so raw for so long after, like for months, I was just like everyone could see everything. Like, and I was so sensitive and yeah.
Yeah, that sensitivity part makes sense to me that you would feel if you come off of a substance that you were totally exposed because obviously substances change the brain, change someone's personality. I mean, everything changes about a person who is using on a regular basis, right?
Yeah.
So, did you get support in your sobriety?
Yeah, at the time, I still was working. We had sold the business, but I was still working there. There's like a couple of year period of transition. And so my brother was recovering at the time. I had recovered through AA. He was a relatively low functioning alcoholic and he had to detox. And so he was a great support. But my husband, who was also my business partner, was, you know, just a very like, tough love kind of guy. And like, there's really no such thing as addiction. And this is just something you're going to have to deal with. And so when I would mention, like, I think I want to go to a meeting, he would say, like, can't, like, what if you see one of your patients? Like, you know, and in a sense, I understand the point, but it's anonymous, right? Like, we're all in the same boat. So I feel like my pathway was just this kind of like, I did all the things I had wanted to do since I was young. Like, I did jewelry making classes and I took photography classes and I took coding classes, like trying to figure out like what my passion was in life that had been missing, that I'd never found. And so I started volunteering with the incarcerated, formerly incarcerated, through a program that teaches entrepreneurship, which is perfect for me. So when I would go to prison, I would actually be able to talk about my addiction openly. It was the only place I really would feel comfortable talking about it. So yeah, my pathway was just like, I would just like all the things, everything you can think of, I would do except for actually dealing with the problem. But, you know, it worked for what it was. I felt great. I was making, and I was writing about my addiction. I was making art. I had done a photography certificate, so I was making art about it. My art was getting into galleries. So I felt connected to recovery, even though not in a formal way. But yeah, that was sort of my pathway.
And did you ever relapse?
No, the closest I came was, so I had a really good 5 years, right? Like I did all the things for 5 years and had a good marriage and was splitting time between New York City and like rural Pennsylvania. Like I had a life like I could never have even imagined growing up in Canada. And so I guess that what happened was I didn't realize the effect that my sobriety had had on my husband. I didn't ask him if it was okay that I was writing about it. And I was writing things that were getting like published in very, very small publications, or that I was making art about it. And I think I should have known he was super disinterested in any time there would be like any recognition. And so I should have known that he wasn't comfortable with it, but it was so important to me. I didn't ask. I didn't stop to say like, hey, is it okay if I share this part of my life? And so he, after we sold the business, didn't find his passion, didn't find anything. He just was kind of floating. He couldn't find his purpose. He couldn't find his footing. And so like I had moved so far past that whole like success, money thing, and he was still deeply in it. And I think that our values just really diverged. And he woke up one day and left. I can't explain it. Like we had dinner the night before, walked the dogs, talked about his like finding his purpose. We talked about him seeing like a performance coach maybe to help figure out what he wanted to do next. And I guess he might have thought this for a while, I don't know, but that I was the problem, right? That I was sort of stopping him from finding what he really wanted to do because I was sort of this sober, like, you know, advocate for mental health. You know, I changed a lot. And I think I wasn't as fun. It turns out I'm way more introverted. I think the shock, you know, he never really said it's about the drinking. He said like, it's hard for me to connect with people because you don't drink and you're super introverted. I got very close to I have three nieces and I didn't want to be around them when I was drinking because their dad drank and he hadn't seen them in many years, my brother. So yeah, I just became someone else. You know, I wasn't at a club at 2 a.m. I was making a pie with my 8-year-old niece, like at 2 p.m.
But you must have felt very abandoned if he just left you without any warning.
There's no words. I still don't have the words for it. And it's been, you know, over a year. I still don't. I just knew that my sobriety was not guaranteed for once. I don't know if I had been naive to think that, well, once you get the 5 years, you know, but I remember the next morning after he left and I thought, there's no way. There's just no way I'll stay sober. And why? Like, why would I stay sober? I got sober for this beautiful life and like that life is gone. And I don't even know. I don't even have ideas on how to rebuild a life. And so I was at like a really tough point. And I don't know why, but he left me with our two tiny dogs and they're geriatric and they're just adorable. And so I was walking them and I thought, I'm going to go back to the apartment and I'm going to log into a meeting. I'm just going to go to it's like a non-12-step community meeting that a couple girlfriends in New York had told me about. And I logged into the 8 a.m. meeting and I went every day for months. Mm-hmm. And it just was like this sense of comfort. And I had a support system. I had a great support system. I have like wonderful sister-in-laws that literally would put their life on hold to help me, that kept me in their homes for like a month, you know, and great nieces. And I had a friend going through a divorce and I have amazing neighbors. Like I have a support system, but unless someone has gone through sobriety, I think that there's something that they just can't understand about how you process emotions.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I've never been through addiction and recovery. You've never been through the death of a child. You know, I mean, I just think like, unless you've been through something, you don't really understand it, right? I mean, you can empathize.
No.
but you can't really get into the skin of that other human being.
Yeah, like I can say, right, like logically, I think the death of a child is the hardest thing that anyone could ever go through. And I get that. But unless you've been through it, you don't know what to say. And that saying, you know, not people never said the wrong thing to me, but that there were things that just that you don't get it. Like when I feel shame or I feel guilt, my instinct is to isolate and numb, right? And so I wanted to lean on people, but there's also a reason I drank was because I couldn't lean on people. I didn't know how. And I hadn't developed that in the 5 years that I'd been sober because I didn't need it, right? Like I had this great life. And so, you know, my sister-in-laws were just there, like ready to help. And so they were insistent. And so I was very lucky that I had them to lean on. But there's only so much you want to be like, and I feel like drinking. What am I going to do about that? You know?
Yeah. But you were able, because of this support group, this virtual support group, you were able to maintain your sobriety.
Yeah, I would say it was a combination of all those things. I would say it was like having that consistency in the mornings and at least knowing there were other people struggling with their sobriety was great. I think having my family was great. And I think that I did have a lot of skills from being sober. They just weren't like necessarily at like rebuilding a life. But I, you know, I was journaling and I had these like nighttime rituals where I would light candles. And so the first few weeks, I just wanted to like light the house on fire. Like I could not light a candle. I didn't want to brush my teeth. I mean, I did. I would like the most I would do is like brush my teeth and wash my face at night.
I mean, it's shock and it's loss, right? So it's hard to come to accept it as reality. And that takes time. And I can see how that would really jeopardize your anybody's sobriety to go through shock and loss like that.
Yeah.
Have you lost a loved one to overdose or fentanyl poisoning? I'd like to invite you to share their story on our new Emily's Hope Memorial website called More Than Just a Number. They were our children, siblings, cousins, husbands, wives, aunts, uncles, and friends. So much more than just a number. You can submit a memorial today on morethanjustanumber.org. While Sonia found the virtual support group to be helpful, she felt hesitant to actively participate and share her story due to the group's large size.
The groups are about 200 people. And so it's like 200 boxes on the Zoom screen and maybe 10, 15 people are actually on camera. And it wasn't where I was going to share. I didn't need to vent, right? I didn't want to just like raise my hand and like vent for 2 minutes because there's a timer. They time you for 2 minutes and then be done. I like desperately needed feedback. And that was actually something I was getting from my sister-in-laws where I was like, I'm never going to be okay. And like, no, you are going to be okay. And it's like, that's all you need. And so I just wasn't getting that in those groups. It was sort of like a passive recovery style. And then if you look at other models like AA, you simply aren't even allowed to crosstalk, right? And I was like, I want a crosstalk. Like, I need some crosstalk. Let me look for something like that. And I don't know if you sort of understand this, but like when people are at the beginning of sobriety, like the first like 30, 60, 90 days, that is a rough time. And when there's 200 people, you want to give priority to those people and say, you know, you need to talk, you need to get out whatever is going on. And my husband's still going to be gone in 6 months. Like, I'm not going to interrupt someone who's like, I'm going to drink like right now. I, you know, whatever. I had a horrible day. I don't know how I'm going to get through this craving. And I just didn't want to be the one to interrupt with this sob story about my husband. And so I thought that's another thing I need is I need people that are also going through something or some point in something that can give that feedback, right? And so like, for example, like now I could give feedback to somebody in their first 1 to 2 months of like a life transition, like a major life overhaul. And so I looked for, you know, a group that would have that. So where people are sober and then they're experiencing different things. And I thought like, what are the horrible things I've experienced? And I thought, well, I had really bad job burnout. I've had like self-esteem, like imposter syndrome, especially with my career. And now I'm having this issue with life transition. I also had an issue being a healthcare provider, trying to find a support group. And so I thought maybe there is a space where we could sort of curate groups based on what people are going through, right? So everyone sort of feels like they can share and have them a size where you can share and the consistency. So I didn't want to have to get on a group and tell them every time the story,
right?
Of how I don't want to be like, and so he left, and yeah.
Yeah. I think that commonality is so important. So at Emily's Hope, we started a support group. It's an in-person support group for now, but it's for people who have lost a loved one to overdose or fentanyl poisoning. And the first one is going. I'm actually taking part in the first one because it's brand new and I want to see how it worked and participate in it. And I probably need the help too. I'm 5 years out from losing my daughter to fentanyl poisoning. But it has been so interesting to have these 6-7 women together in a room who all come from the same place, who all had something very similar happen to them, a stigmatized death, because you can go to lots of different bereavement groups. But, you know, if you lost your child to cancer, or you lost your child to something else. So I can see the value in having a commonality and also having it be small, because it seems like there's so much bonding that goes on in those kinds of groups.
I can't agree more. Yeah. And I think that, like, you could compare, like, okay, so there's Al-Anon, but then there's the Emily's Hope support group, you know, for people who have lost a child to fentanyl. It's like one can say, like, well, it's kind of the same thing, but it's not, right? It is in one sense, but it's not in the parts that you really want to talk about. And so, yeah, my experience now at 6 years sober, trying to rebuild a life, is different than someone who's 10 days sober and just try and get through the next week. And so I think there is something to be said for that commonality.
Sonya was looking for that community in small online support groups for substance use disorder, but she was struggling to find something that fit her needs. That's when she decided to create her own program. Everbloom offers a unique approach to online recovery meetings featuring small groups led by a dedicated recovery coach facilitator. They carefully match members based on their individual challenges.
And so how many different groups do you have meeting at any one time? How does it work at Everbloom?
Yeah, so they can try out a free meeting. And so they try it out and then they fill out a survey, and it's not super in depth, but at least we get to, like, what exactly is it that you're struggling with? And then there's a section where you can just say, like, look, I checked all these boxes, but this is really what's bugging me. And then we just find a group that, you know, matches best. And so what we have the most of is early sobriety groups. That is also, like, that is a special hell, being sober from 0 to 90 days. And there's different things you want to talk about. So in that group, we talk a lot about developing tools. And we talk about a lot about very practical things, which is like, I'm going to a concert on Saturday night. How do I not drink? And that's pretty different than the self-esteem group, right? And so that's a whole different kind of feeling, or a job burnout group or healthcare workers group. And so, yeah, and I found, especially with the healthcare workers, I hadn't even heard this term, but a lot of them have said the word secondary trauma, which you don't get as an orthodontist, but that helping people through such, like, difficult things day after day is traumatic. Like, someone has their trauma, but just talking to them, for, like, people that are therapists, psychiatrists, that type of thing, they are taking on a lot of that. And so that's somewhere where they can have that conversation, right?
So you're offering groups for more than people who are in recovery then?
So the center of every group is recovery, right? So
Okay. Everybody, okay.
Is in recovery. When I came up with the idea, before I actually launched, I wanted to figure out, like, is this something that exists? I interviewed tons of people. And so it was like, okay, let me draw it out. And I wrote sober at the center of a circle. And then I put spokes coming out and said, what are the other issues that people that are sober or just humans deal with that can affect your sobriety and that require, like, a deeper conversation? And so, yeah, everybody starts with being sober, but depending on the group, there's a certain amount of discussion about sobriety, and then there's a certain amount of discussion about other things. But it's a nice part about a small group is, last night we had an early sobriety group and someone asked, how do I not transfer this addiction to something else? Like, how do I quit alcohol but not end up overeating or, you know, watching 30 hours of Netflix? And honestly, like, it resonated with so many people. Because the group is small, we spent the next 20 minutes talking about it. And that's something you can't do in other groups, where you can't shift based on what people are going through that exact moment. And it honestly was so helpful for me too. And so,
sure. Yeah. Sure. That's a very common thing, transfer of addiction. And so how are you doing now a year later? Has it been a year since your marriage ended? Yeah. How are you doing?
I mean, I don't know. I think people want to hear that I'm like amazing and like that.
Well, you know, there's you can look that way on social media all you want.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, go on Instagram and look like everything's perfect, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think anytime a marriage breaks up after, you know, we were together 18 years, I think that's a tragedy. I still do. I think that we should work it out. And like, there was nothing between us that couldn't have been worked out. But I also feel like I believe it happened for a reason now, which I did not believe before, other than to make me miserable, I thought was the reason. But now I believe that there's something that I was meant to do that I couldn't do when I was with this person. And so it's just a different life and it's like a parallel life, but I haven't yet decided if it's a better life, if that makes sense.
But it sounds to me like you forged a whole new path because of it, because you sought out that help. Then you forged a whole new path and now you're helping others, which is all we can really do with what life hands us, the suffering that life hands us. We have a choice. You know, are we going to make something out of this that can help other people? Or are we going to wallow in our own suffering or go, you know, relapse, that kind of thing? But you made a very definite choice to do something really positive with this tragedy that happened in your life.
Yeah. I mean, a couple of months after I got the idea, I really was like, I don't want to like reinvent the wheel. So I did tons of interviews and I became a recovery coach. And that was amazing. And so, every step in the last year has gotten me kind of closer to like who I really want to be and what I want to do. And so, I have an infinite amount of hope, but I still have, I'm sure you do too. You still have like really bad days where you know there was a reason, but you just don't see it in that day.
And I don't know if I believe the reason. I don't think there was a reason. I don't think my daughter had to die. I think circumstances created the tragedy, but I think that all I have left is what I can do with it, right? So this podcast is part of that and meeting so many people who are doing things like I'm doing, like you're doing, you know, that they're taking like the worst thing that happened to them and they're trying to create meaning out of it and move forward.
Yeah. And I think that you can only help people if you've been through it. And I think I feel worn out like when I get done with a meeting sometimes because I put so much emotion into it. Like I feel so, even talking to you, like I feel so emotional about it. I don't think I've ever felt that passionate about anything. And recovery is just sort of like, I could talk about recovery all day, every day, and meet people in recovery all day, every day, and never get bored, as opposed to, tightening a wire in somebody's mouth.
But you're doing what I've often heard is the antidote for addiction, connection. You're creating those connections for people.
Yeah. And I think I don't have a traditional family. I didn't have kids and not, you know, close with my parents or my brother, but I have this sort of like non-traditional chosen family of my sister-in-laws, my nieces and my neighbors and everything. And I thought like, that's all we need, right? It's okay if I don't have a husband and I don't have, you know, and I just am super grateful. I was super grateful for what I have. And I think that that also really helped. We just need to connect. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, I just very impressed by everything that you're doing. I'm glad that you're turning what is a very troubling thing into something positive for you and for others. And I just want to thank you so much for joining me for the podcast.
Thank you for having me. And thank you for doing what you do, too.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Grieving Out Loud. If you're interested in learning more about Everbloom, be sure to check out the show notes for this episode. If you found this episode helpful, we would really appreciate it if you'd leave us a positive review and share it with your friends and family. By doing so, you're helping us get the word out about the drug and alcohol crisis and hopefully prevent more tragedies. Thanks again for tuning in. Until next time, wishing you faith, hope, and courage. This podcast is produced by Casey Wunnenberg-King and Anna Fye.